Do you think they are taking you back to dark ages? They are taking you back to darker ages than any your history has known. Their goal is not the era of pre-science, but the era of pre-language. Their purpose is to deprive you of the concept on which man's mind, his life, and his culture depend, the concept of an objective reality. Identify the development of a human consciousness, and you will know the purpose of their creed. A savage is a being who has not grasped that A is A, and that reality is real. He has arrested his mind at the level of a baby's, at the stage when a consciousness acquires its initial sensory perceptions, and has not learned to distinguish solid objects. It is to a baby that the world appears as a blur of motion, without things that move, and the birth of his mind is the day when he grasps that the streak that keeps flickering past him is his mother, and the world beyond her is a curtain, and that the two are solid entities, and neither can turn into the other, that they are what they are, that they exist. The day when he grasps that matter has no volition is the day when he grasps that he has. And this is his birth as a human being. The day when he grasps that the reflection he sees in a mirror is not a delusion, that it is real, but it is not himself, that the mirage he sees in a desert is not a delusion, that the air and the light rays that cause it are real, but it is not a city, it is a city's reflection. The day when he grasps that he is not a passive recipient of the sensations of any given moment, that his senses do not provide him with automatic knowledge in separate snatches independent of context, but only with the material of knowledge which his mind must learn to integrate. The day when he grasps that his senses cannot deceive him, that physical objects cannot act without causes, that his organs of perception are physical and have no volition, no power to invent or to distort, that the evidence they give him is an absolute, but his mind must learn to understand it, his mind must discover the nature, the causes, the full context of his sensory material, the mind must identify the things that he perceives. That is the day of his birth as a thinker and scientist. We are the men who reach that day. You are the men who choose to reach it partly. A savage is a man who never does. To a savage, the world is a place of unintelligible miracles, where anything is possible to inanimate matter, and nothing is possible to him. His world is not the unknown, but that irrational horror, the unknowable. He believes that physical objects are endowed with a mysterious volition, moved by causeless, unpredictable whims, while he is a helpless pawn at the mercy of forces beyond his control. He believes that nature is ruled by demons who possess an omnipotent power, and that reality is their fluid plaything where they can turn his bowl of meal into a snake and his wife into a beetle at any moment, where the A he has never discovered can be any non-A they choose, where the only knowledge he possesses is that he must not attempt to know. He can count on nothing. He can only wish. And he spends his life on wishing, on begging his demons to grant him his wishes by the arbitrary power of their will, giving them credit when they do, taking the blame when they don't, offering them sacrifices in token of his gratitude, and sacrifices in token of his guilt, crawling on his belly in fear and worship of sun and moon and wind and rain and of any thug who announces himself as their spokesman, provided his words are unintelligible and his mask sufficiently frightening. He wishes, begs, and crawls, and dies, leaving you as a record of his view of existence, the distorted monstrosities of his idols, part man, part animal, part spider, the embodiments of the world of non-A. His is the intellectual state of your modern teachers, and his is the world to which they want to bring you. If you wonder by what means they propose to do it, walk into any college classroom and you will hear your professors teaching your children that man can be certain of nothing, that his consciousness has no validity whatever, that he can learn no facts and no laws of existence, that he's incapable of knowing an objective reality. What then is his standard of knowledge and truth? Whatever others believe is their answer. There is no knowledge they teach, there's only faith. Your belief that you exist is an act of faith, no more valid than another's faith in his right to kill you. The axioms of science are an act of faith, no more valid than a mystic's faith in revelations. The belief that electric light can be produced by a generator is an act of faith, no more valid than the belief that it can be produced by a rabbit's foot kissed under a stepladder on the first of the moon. Truth is whatever people want it to be, and people are everyone except yourself. Reality is whatever people choose to say it is. There are no objective facts. There are only people's arbitrary wishes. A man who seeks knowledge in a laboratory by means of test tubes and logic is an old-fashioned, superstitious fool. A true scientist is a man who goes around taking public polls. And if it weren't for the selfish greed of the manufacturers of steel girders, who have a vested interest in obstructing the progress of science, you would learn that New York City does not exist, because a poll of the entire population of the world would tell you by a landslide majority that their beliefs forbid its existence. For centuries, the mystics of spirit have proclaimed that faith is superior to reason, but have not dared deny the existence of reason. Their heirs and product, the mystics of muscle, have completed their job and achieved their dream. They proclaim that everything is faith, and call it a revolt against believing. As revolt against unproved assertions, they proclaim that nothing can be proved. As revolt against supernatural knowledge, they proclaim that no knowledge is possible. As revolt against the enemies of science, they proclaim that science is superstition. As revolt against the enslavement of the mind, they proclaim that there is no mind. If you surrender your power to perceive, if you accept the switch of your standard from the objective to the collective, and wait for mankind to tell you what to think, you will find another switch taking place before the eyes you have renounced. You will find that your teachers become the rulers of the collective, and if you then refuse to obey them, protesting that they are not the whole of mankind, they will answer, "By what means do you know that we are not?" "Are, brother? Where did you get that old-fashioned term?" If you doubt that such is their purpose, observe with what passionate consistency the mystics of muscle are striving to make you forget that a concept such as mind has ever existed. Observe the twists of undefined verbiage, the words with rubber meanings, the terms left floating in midstream, by means of which they try to get around the recognition of the concept of thinking. Your consciousness, they tell you, consists of reflexes, reactions, experiences, urges, and drives, and refuse to identify the means by which they acquired that knowledge, to identify the act they are performing when they tell it, or the act you are performing when you listen. Words have the power to condition you, they say, and refuse to identify the reason why words have the power to change your blank out. A student reading a book understands it through a process of blank out. A scientist working on an invention is engaged in the activity of blank out. A psychologist helping a neurotic to solve a problem and untangle a conflict does it by means of blank out. An industrialist, blank out. There is no such person. A factory is a natural resource, like a tree, a rock, or a mud puddle. The problem of production, they tell you, has been solved and deserves no study or concern. The only problem left for your reflexes to solve is now the problem of distribution. Who solved the problem of production? Humanity, they answer. What was the solution? The goods are here. How did they get here? Somehow. What caused it? Nothing has causes. They proclaim that every man born is entitled to exist without labor, and the laws of reality, to the contrary, notwithstanding, is entitled to receive his minimum sustenance, his food, his clothes, his shelter, with no effort on his part, as his due and his birthright, to receive it. From whom? Blank out. Every man, they announce, owns an equal share of the technological benefits created in the world. Created by whom? Blank out. Frantic cowards who posture as defenders of industrialists now define the purpose of economics as an adjustment between the unlimited desires of men and the goods supplied in limited quantity. Supplied by whom? Blank out. Intellectual hoodlums who pose as professors shrug away the thinkers of the past by declaring that their social theories were based on the impractical assumption that man was a rational being. But since men are not rational, they declare, There ought to be established a system that will make it possible for them to exist while being irrational, which means while defying reality. Who will make it possible? Blank out. Any stray mediocrity rushes into print with plans to control the production of mankind, and whoever agrees or disagrees with his statistics, no one questions his right to enforce his plans by means of a gun. Enforce on whom? Blank out. Random females with causeless incomes flitter on trips around the globe and return to deliver the message that the backward peoples of the world demand a higher standard of living. Demand of whom? Blank out. And to forestall any inquiry into the cause of the difference between a jungle village and New York City, they resort to the ultimate obscenity of explaining man's industrial progress, skyscrapers, cable bridges, power motors, railroad trains, by declaring that man is an animal who possesses an instinct of tool-making. Did you wonder what is wrong with the world? You are now seeing the climax of the creed of the uncaused and unearned. All your gangs of mystics, of spirit or muscle, are fighting one another for power to rule you, snarling that love is the solution for all the problems of your spirit, and that a whip is the solution for all the problems of your body, you who have agreed to have no mind. Granting man less dignity than they grant to cattle, ignoring what an animal trainer could tell them, that no animal can be trained by fear, that a tortured elephant will trample its torturer, but will not work for him or carry his burdens, they expect man to continue to produce electronic tubes, supersonic airplanes, atom-smashing engines, and interstellar telescopes. With his ration of meat for reward, and a lash on his back for incentive. Make no mistake about the character of mystics. To undercut your consciousness has always been their only purpose throughout the ages. And power, the power to rule you by force, has always been their only lust. From the rites of the jungle witch doctors, which distorted reality into grotesque absurdities, stunted the minds of their victims and kept them in terror of the supernatural for stagnant stretches of centuries, to the supernatural doctrines of the Middle Ages, which kept men huddling on the mud floors of their hovels, in terror that the devil might steal the soup they had worked 18 hours to earn, to the seedy little smiling professor who assures you that your brain has no capacity to think, that you have no means of perception and must blindly obey the omnipotent will of that supernatural force, society. All of it is the same performance for the same and only purpose, to reduce you to the kind of pulp that has surrendered the validity of its consciousness. But it cannot be done to you without your consent. If you permit it to be done, you deserve it. When you listen to a mystic's harangue on the impotence of the human mind and begin to doubt your consciousness, not his, when you permit your precariously semi-rational state to be shaken by any assertion and decide it is safer to trust his superior certainty and knowledge, the joke is on both of you. Your sanction is the only source of certainty he has. The supernatural power that a mystic dreads, the unknowable spirit he worships, the consciousness he considers omnipotent is yours. A mystic is a man who surrendered his mind at its first encounter with the minds of others. Somewhere in the distant reaches of his childhood, when his own understanding of reality clashed with the assertions of others, with their arbitrary orders and contradictory demands, he gave in to so craven a fear of independence that he renounced his rational faculty. At the crossroads of the choice between I know and they say, he chose the authority of others. He chose to submit rather than to understand, to believe rather than to think. Faith in the supernatural begins as faith in the superiority of others. His surrender took the form of the feeling that he must hide his lack of understanding, that others possess some mysterious knowledge of which he alone is deprived, that reality is whatever they want it to be, through some means forever denied to him. From then on, afraid to think, he is left at the mercy of unidentified feelings. His feelings become his only guide, his only remnant of personal identity. He clings to them with ferocious possessiveness, and whatever thinking he does is devoted to the struggle of hiding from himself that the nature of his feelings is terror. When a mystic declares that he feels the existence of a power superior to reason, he feels it all right, but that power is not an omniscient super-spirit of the universe. It is the consciousness of any passerby to whom he has surrendered his own. A mystic is driven by the urge to impress, to cheat, to flatter, to deceive, to force that omnipotent consciousness of others. They are his only key to reality. He feels that he cannot exist save by harnessing their mysterious power and extorting their unaccountable consent. They are his only means of perception, and like a blind man who depends on the sight of a dog, he feels he must leash them in order to live. To control the consciousness of others becomes his only passion. Power lust is a weed that grows only in the vacant lots of an abandoned mind. Every dictator is a mystic, and every mystic is a potential dictator. A mystic craves obedience from men, not their agreement. He wants them to surrender their consciousness to his assertions, his edicts, his wishes, his whims, as his consciousness is surrendered to theirs. He wants to deal with men by means of faith and force. He finds no satisfaction in their consent if he must earn it by means of facts and reason. Reason is the enemy he dreads and simultaneously considers precarious. Reason to him is a means of deception. He feels that men possess some power more potent than reason, and only their causeless belief or their forced obedience can give him a sense of security, a proof that he has gained control of the mystic endowment he lacked. His lust is to command, not to convince. Conviction requires an act of independence and rests on the absolute of an objective reality. What he seeks is power over reality and over men's means of perceiving it, their mind, the power to interpose his will between existence and consciousness. As if by agreeing to fake the reality he orders them to fake, men would in fact create it. Just as the mystic is a parasite in matter, who expropriates the wealth created by others, just as he is a parasite in spirit, who plunders the ideas created by others, so he falls below the level of a lunatic who creates his own distortion of reality to the level of a parasite of lunacy who seeks a distortion created by others. There is only one state that fulfills the mystic's longing for infinity, non-causality, non-identity. Death. No matter what unintelligible causes he ascribes to his incommunicable feelings, whoever rejects reality rejects existence, and the feelings that move him from then on are hatred for all the values of man's life, and lust for all the evils that destroy it. A mystic relishes the spectacle of suffering, of poverty, subservience, and terror. These give him a feeling of triumph, a proof of the defeat of rational reality. But no other reality exists. No matter whose welfare he professes to serve, be it the welfare of God or of that disembodied gargoyle he describes as the people, no matter what ideal he proclaims in terms of some supernatural dimension, in fact, in reality, on earth, his ideal is death. His craving is to kill. His only satisfaction is to torture. Destruction is the only end that the mystic's creed has ever achieved, as it is the only end that you see them achieving today. And if the ravages wrought by their acts have not made them question their doctrines, if they profess to be moved by love, yet are not deterred by piles of human corpses, it is because the truth about their souls is worse than the obscene excuse you have allowed them, the excuse that the end justifies the means, and that the horrors they practice are means to nobler ends. The truth is that those horrors are their ends. You who are depraved enough to believe that you could adjust yourself to a mystic's dictatorship and could please him by obeying his orders. There is no way to please him. When you obey, he will reverse his orders. He seeks obedience for the sake of obedience and destruction for the sake of destruction. You who are craven enough to believe that you can make terms with a mystic by giving in to his extortions. There is no way to buy him off. The bribe he wants is your life as slowly or as fast as you are willing to give it in. And the monster he seeks to bribe is the hidden blank out in his mind, which drives him to kill in order not to learn that the death he desires is his own. You who are innocent enough to believe that the forces let loose in your world today are moved by greed for material plunder, the mystic scramble for spoils is only a screen to conceal from their mind the nature of their motive. Wealth is a means of human life, and they clamor for wealth in imitation of living beings, to pretend to themselves that they desire to live, but their swinish indulgence in plundered luxury is not enjoyment, it is escape. They do not want to own your fortune. They want you to lose it. They do not want to succeed. They want you to fail. They do not want to live. They want you to die. They desire nothing. They hate existence, and they keep running, each trying not to learn that the object of his hatred is himself. You who've never grasped the nature of evil, you who describe them as misguided idealists, may the gods you invented forgive you. They are the essence of evil. They, those anti-living objects, who seek by devouring the world to fill the selfless zero of their soul. It is not your wealth that they're after. Theirs is a conspiracy against the mind, which means against life and man. It is a conspiracy without leader or direction. And the random little thugs of the moment who cash in on the agony of one land or another are chance scum, riding the torrent from the broken dam of the sewer of centuries, from the reservoir of hatred for reason, for logic, for ability, for achievement, for joy, stored by every whining anti-human who ever preached the superiority of the heart over the mind. It is a conspiracy of all those who seek not to live but to get away with living, those who seek to cut just one small corner of reality and are drawn by feeling to all the others who are busy cutting other corners, a conspiracy that unites by links of evasion all those who pursue a zero as a value. The professor who, unable to think, takes pleasure in crippling the mind of his students. The businessman who, to protect his stagnation, takes pleasure in chaining the ability of competitors. The neurotic who, to defend his self-loathing, takes pleasure in breaking men of self-esteem. The incompetent who takes pleasure in defeating achievement. The mediocrity who takes pleasure in demolishing greatness. The eunuch who takes pleasure in the castration of all pleasure. And all their intellectual munition makers, all those who preach that the immolation of virtue will transform vices into virtue. Death is the premise at the root of their theories. Death is the goal of their actions in practice. And you are the last of their victims. We, who were the living buffers between you and the nature of your creed, are no longer there to save you from the effects of your chosen beliefs. We are no longer willing to pay with our lives the debts you incurred in yours, or the moral deficit piled up by all the generations behind you. You had been living on borrowed time, and I am the man who has called in the loan. I am the man whose existence your blank-outs were intended to permit you to ignore. I am the man whom you did not want either to live or to die. You did not want me to live because you were afraid of knowing that I carried the responsibility you dropped and that your lives depended on me. You did not want me to die because you knew it. 12 years ago, when I worked in your world, I was an inventor. I was one of a profession that came last in human history and will be first to vanish on the way back to the subhuman. An inventor is a man who asks, why, of the universe, and lets nothing stand between the answer and his mind. Like the man who discovered the use of steam, or the man who discovered the use of oil, I discovered a source of energy which was available since the birth of the globe, but which men had not known how to use except as an object of worship, of terror, and of legends about a thundering god. I completed the experimental model of a motor that would have made a fortune for me and for those who had hired me, a motor that would have raised the efficiency of every human installation using power, and would have added the gift of higher productivity to every hour you spend at earning your living. Then one night at a factory meeting, I heard myself sentenced to death by reason of my achievement. I heard 3 parasites assert that my brain and my life were their property, that my right to exist was conditional and depended on the satisfaction of their desires. The purpose of my ability, they said, was to serve the needs of those who were less able. I had no right to live, they said, by reason of my competence for living. Their right to live was unconditional by reason of their incompetence. Then I saw what was wrong with the world. I saw what destroyed men and nations, and where the battle for life had to be fought. I saw that the enemy was an inverted morality, and that my sanction was its only power. I saw that evil was impotent, that evil was the irrational, the blind, the anti-real, and that the only weapon of its triumph was the willingness of the good to serve it. just as the parasites around me were proclaiming their helpless dependence on my mind, and were expecting me voluntarily to accept a slavery they had no power to enforce, just as they were counting on my self-immolation to provide them with the means of their plan, so throughout the world and throughout men's history, in every version and form, from the extortions of loafing relatives to the atrocities of collectivized countries, it is the good, the able, the men of reason, who act as their own destroyers, who transfuse to evil the blood of their virtue, and let evil transmit to them the poison of destruction, thus gaining for evil the power of survival, and for their own values, the impotence of death. I saw that there comes a point in the defeat of any man of virtue when his own consent is needed for evil to win, and that no manner of injury done to him by others can succeed if he chooses to withhold his consent. I saw that I could put an end to your outrages by pronouncing a single word in my mind. I pronounced it. The word was, no. I quit that factory. I quit your world. I made it my job to warn your victims and to give them the method and the weapon to fight you. The method was to refuse to deflect retribution. The weapon was justice. If you want to know what you lost when I quit and when my strikers deserted your world, stand on an empty stretch of soil in a wilderness unexplored by men, and ask yourself what manner of survival you would achieve and how long you would last if you refused to think, with no one around to teach you the motions, or if you chose to think, how much your mind would be able to discover. Ask yourself how many independent conclusions you have reached in the course of your life, and how much of your time was spent on performing the actions you learned from others. Ask yourself whether you would be able to discover how to till the soil and grow your food, whether you would be able to invent a wheel, a lever, an induction coil, a generator, an electronic tube. Then decide whether men of ability are exploiters who live by the fruit of your labor and rob you of the wealth that you produce, and whether you dare to believe that you possess the power to enslave them. Let your women take a look at a jungle female with her shriveled face and pendulous breasts, as she sits grinding meal in a bowl hour after hour, century by century. Then let them ask themselves whether their instinct of tool-making will provide them with their electric refrigerators, their washing machines, and vacuum cleaners, and if not, whether they care to destroy those who provided it all, but not by instinct. Take a look around you, you savages, who stutter that ideas are created by men's means of production, that a machine is not the product of human thought, but a mystical power that produces human thinking. You have never discovered the industrial age, and you cling to the morality of the barbarian eras, when a miserable form of human subsistence was produced by the muscular labor of slaves. Every mystic had always longed for slaves to protect him from the material reality he dreaded, but you, you grotesque little atavists, stare blindly at the skyscrapers and smokestacks around you, and dream of enslaving the material providers who are scientists, inventors, industrialists. When you clamor for public ownership of the means of production, you are clamoring for public ownership of the mind. I have taught my strikers that the answer you deserve is only, try and get it. You proclaim yourself unable to harness the forces of inanimate matter, yet propose to harness the minds of men who are able to achieve the feats you cannot equal. You proclaim that you cannot survive without us, yet propose to dictate the terms of our survival. You proclaim that you need us, yet indulge the impertinence of asserting your right to rule us by force, and expect that we, who are not afraid of that physical nature which fills you with terror, will cower at the sight of any lout who has talked you into voting him a chance to command us. You propose to establish a social order based on the following tenets: that you're incompetent to run your own life, but competent to run the lives of others; that you're unfit to exist in freedom, but fit to become an omnipotent ruler; that you're unable to earn your living by the use of your own intelligence, but able to judge politicians and to vote them into jobs of total power over arts you have never seen, over sciences you have never studied, over achievements of which you have no knowledge, over the gigantic industries where you, by your own definition of your capacity, would be unable successfully to fill the job of assistant greaser. This idle,